Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourselves up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economic. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Oh, Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him, and then you felt like you wasn't worthy, and so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room, and I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me, and I said, I want you to do this graph for me, and that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street.
That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
That's how we work. That's how. Friends, it is time once again for our daily message of hope. And with today's message, here is Richard Eaton.
Friends, to brighten your day, here is our message of hope. Do you sometimes feel sorry for yourself? Sorry for yourself because of many responsibilities, many problems, many unpleasant situations? Don't worry. Don't feel sorry for yourself. Happiness, serenity, even a more satisfying life will come to you in greater degree as the load you carry grows weightier. The natural way to live is under a load. As soon as a baby can walk, he wants to carry something. Ever think of that? Sometimes he may pick up a load too heavy, may get him down, may fall on top of it, but he's happy. Even then, he has something to struggle with. Under your load, you are anchored and growing. You won't drift rudderless. A ship in ballast is an easy prey to winds and waves. A cargo gives her steadiness and aids the ship to safety, helps keep a true course. Likewise, the biggest handicap for a human being is moving through life with no steadying cargo. The young man with responsibilities will survive in shifting economic seas. Without a load, he's liable to sink. A man with no responsibilities flirts with doom. He'd better pick up a load at once. The workers survive. The shirkers often sink. Abraham Lincoln scaled the magnificent summits of greatness, carrying responsibilities too heavy for most men to bear. But Lincoln's heart and soul grew until they were capable of tremendous understanding. The burdens he carried only broadened his shoulders and deepened his great sympathies and tolerance for fellow men. Under his crushing load, he was yet able to lift up a bleeding nation and carry it to peace and safety. Had no burdens been thrust upon him, the great Lincoln might well have never have attained any greatness at all. Young and old are still lifted up by heavy, useful loads. Those who refuse responsibility may grow fat, but they lose the heights of greatness. They come crashing down to valleys of despair, smashed because they carried no load. A life with no burdens is an empty life, a useless life. But differently, those who disdain burdens during youth and middle age will ultimately bear burdens they never chose, despair, and the crushing burden of loneliness. The loads we try to avoid can often smash us. For responsibilities evaded in youth will come the regrets of old age. So when you next begin to feel sorry for yourself, to feel you bear more than your just share of burdens, stop, think, take inventories, be thankful that God has given you the strength and courage and ability to overcome whatever problem arises to confront you. If you have many responsibilities, you're much more fortunate than the man who has none. Don't waste time envying the other man. He deserves pity, not envy. Do you find life interesting, gratifying? Or are you unhappy because there seem to be many displeasing situations in your life? You don't know how to change them. Has it ever occurred to you that what now brings heartache and disappointment, disillusion, even disgust, may perhaps actually be the growing pains of eventual progress and attainment of what you want in life? Get the habit of looking at what now seems disheartening as unpleasant simply as a growing pain. Suddenly things won't appear nearly so difficult. It's amazing. Obstacles can be turned into opportunity. Tremendous opportunity for growth and for happiness. Don't you remember your growing pains of childhood? Don't you remember that finally someone told you those pains in the legs meant you were getting bigger? Yes. And you were. At that time, wasn't the objective of getting bigger your heart's desire? Remember how all at once then the growing pains stopped? And they did. That's part of life too. Why must we take the growing pains of adult life so much more seriously than those of childhood? There's no reason for it. After all, if we take the attitude that we are stronger than any problem, that any situation contains its solution, it's tremendously affected us. Our whole life is changed. Yes, the way to grow toward the light is like when nature wants a man, by Angela Morgan. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man. When nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part. When she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise. Watch her method, watch her ways. How she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects. How she hammers him and hurts him. And with mighty blows converts him into trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, and he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, and with every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Yes, nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man, wake a man. When nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, and she yearns with all her soul, to create him large and whole, with what cunning she prepares him, how she goads, never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and in poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget, bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man and fame a man and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets the challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls a mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says. Watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, and his highest powers speeding, blazing newer paths and fine. Yes, when the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning, in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation? Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. Yes, let me repeat some of this poem, which shows so clearly how important are the loads we bear, how necessary to the growth of our soul. When nature wants to drill a man and thrill a man and skill a man, when nature wants to mold a man to play the noblest part, when she yearns with all her heart to create so great and bold a man that all the world shall praise, watch her method, watch her ways, how she ruthlessly perfects whom she royally elects, how she hammers him and hurts him, and with mighty blows converts him to trial shapes of clay, which only nature understands. While his tortured heart is crying, he lifts beseeching hands, how she bends but never breaks, when his good she undertakes, how she uses whom she chooses, as every purpose fuses him, by every art induces him, to try his splendor out. Nature knows what she's about. When nature wants to take a man and shake a man and wake a man, when nature wants to make a man to do the future's will, when she tries with all her skill, she yearns with all her soul to create him large and whole. With what cunning she prepares him, how she goads and never spares him, how she whets him and frets him, and poverty begets him, how she often disappoints whom she sacredly anoints, with what wisdom she will hide him, never minding what betide him, though his genius sob with slighting, and his pride may not forget. Bids him struggle harder yet, makes him lonely, so that only God's high messages shall reach him, so that she may surely teach him what the hierarchy planned, though he may not understand, gives him passions to command, how remorselessly she spurs him, with terrific ardor stirs him, when she poignantly prefers him. Yes, when nature wants to shame a man, and fame a man, and tame a man, when nature wants to shame a man to do his heavenly best, when she tries the highest test that her reckoning may bring, when she reins him and constrains him, so his body scarce contains him, while she fires him and inspires him, keeps him yearning, ever burning for a tantalizing goal, lures and lacerates his soul, sets a challenge for his spirit, draws it higher when he's near it, makes a jungle that he clear it, makes a desert that he fear it, and subdue it if he can. So doth nature make a man, then to test his spirit's wrath, hurls the mountain in his path, puts a bitter choice before him, climb or perish, so she says, watch her purpose, watch her ways. Nature's plan is wondrous kind, could we understand her mind. Fools are they who call her blind, when his feet are torn and bleeding, yet his highest power's speeding, blazing newer paths and finer. When the force that is divine leaps to challenge every failure, and his ardor still is sweet, and love and hope are burning in the presence of defeat, lo the crisis, lo the shout that must call the leader out. When the people need salvation, doth he come to lead the nation. Thus doth nature show her plan, when the world has found a man. And every one of us is that man. Friends, you've been listening once again to our message of hope. God bless you.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm coming along. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Okay. We're supposed to be doing a film review today. I just learned how to speak here. The film, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. So we announced that on Monday. Then I think on Wednesday. And if anybody is interested in discussing that film, 619-768-2945. Let's see. Let me read about it. It was based on the book the film, well, let me do some reading here. It's a classic. And you can watch it. Who said? Okay, here we go. It was a book, first and foremost. And let's see. Starred Lawrence Cook, David Lemieux. I believe that's pronounced. Paula Kelly, Jack Aaron, Paul Butler, J.A. Preston, and Janet Leigh. Let's see, I'm just... Okay. I was looking up Janet Leigh. I'll look more on her later. Okay. The book originally was turned down by publishers in the United States, and it had to go over to England, where they found a black publisher that did print it. And there's a bunch of people here. When you're looking for one thing, you discover other people. Okay, anyway, Spook Who Sat by the Door. Let's see. Now we're trying to find. Okay. Let me play this while I get myself organized on this.
Cause you know they let niggas and blame the nigga. You know that. All the white survivors. It wasn't that white iceberg. It was niggers. I heard them singing while we were sinking. I heard them. Old Man River.
You know, they will let white folks make a movie about any goddamn thing. Look at Hollywood. Scissorhands, give me a fucking break. Somebody is on crack. Somebody's smoking a pipe at the studio. Somebody at the studio was smoking crack. Scissorhands. throw mama from the train. Only white folks can throw their mama from a damn train, and it's a hit fucking movie. Ain't that some crazy shit? Throw mama from the goddamn... What's the other thing? White men can't jump. They don't have to. They own the team. Some white man is at bank right now. Ooh, my niggas are jumping. Oh, jump, nigga. White daddy make you jump. Jump. Oh, jump. Single white female. They'll let white folks make a movie about any fucking thing. But I knew they were crazy when they let them make Driving Miss Daisy. In the 90s, Driving Miss Daisy. Fuck Miss Daisy. I will walk before I drive some goddamn Miss Daisy. Some old Jewish woman, I'll take a bagel and beat the shit out of Miss Daisy. This is the 90s. I'll drive that bitch to an alley and rob her. I will do a carjack. Miss Daisy be on the fucking bus. She fuck with me. See, a lot of you are relating, but a lot of white folks are not laughing. They're holding back because they love that Tar Baby, Aunt Jemima, let's go back bullshit. Oh, me dating, I love it. Fuck that. I don't like that cooning, happy slave bullshit. See, you're white. You can go back. Back to the Future. They like all that shit. You can skip on back. Your little ass is white. I go back. I can only go back so far. Then my black ass is in chains. Fuck you. I'm not going back. Trying to trick a nigga back. Trying to trick a nigga back. Come on, nigga. Come on back. Come back to Jamaica. Come on. No, I'm going to stay here in the 90s where I can tell you to kiss my black ass. I didn't like the ending of that movie. In the rest home, he's feeding it. Oh, you my best friend. I said, look, poison this bitch so I can go home and get some sleep. What they going to do? Let Spike Lee write and direct part two? Driving Miss Daisy some more? But my favorite, I have to confess, I swear, don't tell anybody, Lassie. I love that fucking Lassie. Was that a smart dog? God damn, that dog was smart. Remember how Lassie used to start? That was Lassie whistling. That dog was smart, wasn't it? And then they talked to Lassie like Lassie was a person. You know, they just, white folks talk to Lassie like they grew up. Lassie, hey Lassie. Hi girl. How's your mom? Oh, Lassie. I love you. Call me in an hour, Lassie. I mean, talk to fucking Lassie. I saw one episode where Grandpa drove him somewhere, remember, and had a heart attack. Lassie drove him to the hospital and made a left turn. I said, God damn, Lassie. This is a smart fucking dog. Lassie got dogs killed. I had a little mixed ghetto dog. I must have hit that dog in the head with a hammer. I said, motherfucker, if Lassie can do it, you go do it. I said, you better talk back. I'm going to give you to the Vietnamese family. I bet they'll make your ass talk. You'll holler for help. I bet they'll make you talk. Oh, but that Lassie... And then one episode, they got burglarized. They said, girl, what did they take, girl? What? Were there any niggers? Any dark one, girl? Any real dark ones? That black girl? Make out the police report, Lassie. I used to always like put, you know, your race, because you're black, into movies. I always thought Frankenstein was a nigger. No, because all the white folks were always chasing Frankenstein. Remember? Got him! Got him! He was always running like a nigger. And he grunted like niggers. And when he'd catch him, he's just like a nigga, he'd whoop their ass. He said, I threw motherfuckers all over the place. Rah! I said, get him, nigga. Rah!
He steals shit, remember? And then white people were scared of him like they're scared of niggas. Oh, what was that? What was that? Niggas behind it, him? That shit used to fuck me up. I'm sorry. He'd be trying to catch that nigga, wouldn't he? Some crazy wild shit. No, that's why I can't get ready for the shit. The movies are crazy. White films, I'm sorry, white folks, it's crazy shit. One thing in Hollywood, they don't like black men and they don't like white women. You white women here, some of you are uncle women, so you know what I'm talking about, but the ones that are up on the shit, you know the game. You watch the movies come out of Hollywood, what they think of white women. They don't give a fuck about a white woman. They put you with freaks, Beauty and the Beast. Come on, that's bestiality. A white woman with a fucking monster. I know a monster when I see one. Oh, it's his insides. Fuck that. That's a fucking lion. Have a white lady fucking him all night and shit. Come on. Don't take your kids to see that shit. 4 or 5 years from now, your kid will be in the kitchen fucking the dog singing Beauty and the Beast. Sick shit. King Kong. They ran to get that white woman. Oh, get a white woman. She'll fuck that big gorilla. Get a white woman. Princess and the Frog. Oh, get a pretty white woman. Get a frog. That's freak shit. And a fucking frog. Elephant Man. I love you. White lady. Swamp Thing. White woman. I love you. The fly. Big old green eyes. Thorn. Get a white woman. I love you. Sick shit. That's sick white shit. Put a black woman in these movies and see don't the dialogue change. Put a black lady in The Fly. You big-eyed motherfucker. You'll never buzz on this pussy. I bet when I get this black flag, you get the fuck out of my face. Swamp Thing, you better get your ass back in them pot of greens. I ain't through cooking them greens. Frog, Elephant Man, lion, get your ass in the car. We're going to the zoo to find you somebody, because ain't a goddamn thing happening here. But they just give the white woman dumb lines. I love you. They don't give a fuck about the white lady. If they ain't raping a white lady, if they ain't sexual, if they don't have you fucking everything in the movie, then they chopping your head off. White women aren't safe in a dream. If you fall asleep, Freddy gets after your ass. Freddy gets after you. You cannot be safe in the goddamn dream. And then you guys wonder why the serial killer wants you. He goes to the movie, and the movie says, kill the white woman. In fact, kill about 50 of them. That's some cold shit. And then when they catch the white man, he's crazy. It's hard for him to kill a white man. Look at this white man here. They had it over in death row or some shit. You guys stayed up all night lighting candles. Oh, don't. Oh, no. He was abused. This motherfucker that ate hamburgers, killed them two boys, and ran. Talking about he was crazy. He had good sense. He ran. Crazy. If he ate the hamburgers, went to the police station to talk about it, that's crazy. He was trying to get away. Good sense. Because all of them the same. As long as they're out there, they all the same. When you catch them, they all say the same thing. I'm crazy. I'm out of my head. Yeah, give us 5 minutes, you'll be out your body. Fuck them. We need some nigger judges, those white judges. They see themselves in these white men. We need some nigger judges. Nigger judges break up the bullshit. Look at this Hillside Strangler. You know the one who killed all those white women with 8 different personalities. Sybil's brother. Let him go to the nigger judge. Oh, 8 different personalities? Well, pick one of them motherfuckers who you want to be, because I'm sending somebody's ass to jail. I don't give a damn if it's Steve, Fred, Dave. Somebody's ass is going to jail. So just decide who the fuck you want to be. To break up the bullshit. I don't see how you women take it. I don't see. I don't get it. You guys just so forgiving and loving. Well, because men wouldn't take it. If women went around with serial killers, women and killing men, they'd lock their mom up. They'd lock all women up. You guys just can just, you know, maybe you should get together and, like you do on the telephone, and just go on strike. Have a cross your leg strike. Don't give nobody no pussy for 6 months. Just said, fuck it. See, he just freaked. See? Said, nobody don't get no pussy for 6 months unless you catch the serial killer. They will round up all the motherfuckers. Just the thought of it. No pussy strike, please, sir. No. That's the deal. I get a little carried away because, fuck it, it's real.
But that's why I can't watch television, because it's too wild. Because they got crazy shit on Star Trek, the new generation. Who's writing this futuristic stuff for black folks? Who's writing this? One nigga's blind, the other one like his mother fucked a turtle. Who's writing?
All right, that's the late Paul Mooney, and we're doing a film review today of the movie The Spook Who Sat by the Door. I watched it YouTube, which is a film you can watch it on there for free. And it's based on the book of the same title, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. I'll read some Wikipedia on it. The Spook Who Sat by the Door. Before I even go further, this film, well, it takes place in Chicago. So it reminds me of some stuff you might read in it, read it or hear about Chicago today. But it also reminds me of the current show, which I think is on maybe Showtime. I watch it on Amazon, Snowfall. But anyway, so The Spook Who Sat by the Door is a 1973 action crime drama film based on the 1969 novel of the same name by Sam Greenlee, which was first published in the United Kingdom by Allison and Busby. And Busby, and that was a husband and wife team. She's still living, and her publishing company is still around and doing business. After being ejected by American publishers, it is both satire of the civil rights struggle of the United States of the late 1960s and a serious attempt to focus on the issue of black militancy. Dan Freeman, the titular protagonist, is enlisted by the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, in its elitist espionage program, becoming its token black person. After, and you know what, I'm questioning, define token. I know what, on the surface and historically what it meant, but the United States population as of today is 13% black. But that's when you take in the scope, once again, let's just call this 13% black, 13%, or United States demographic chessboard. If you take a look at the chessboard of the United States, basically, you're not going to find a state that's dominated by blacks. Mississippi has probably the highest percentage of blacks of any of the 50 states. But the majority, typically the blacks that you're going to find in any type of number besides a black township, and most of those black townships are very tiny towns, you know, less than 1,000 people, you know, under 400 people, or even 100. But statewide, Alaska, let's take the whole West Coast. Washington State, the majority of blacks that you're going to find in Washington State primarily live in two metro areas, Seattle and Spokane. The rest of the state is basically white. Oregon, outside of Portland, and even Portland is a small number. Portland, predominantly white state. California, outside of the Bay Area, Los Angeles, and San Diego. All right. California is basically a white state. And you can go all across, even in New York, New York State, get outside of New York City and, you know, maybe Buffalo, Niagara Falls, and Rochester, and I'll throw in Albany, and New York State is mostly white. Even here, I'm in Florida. Okay, you get outside, well, Miami's practically 70% Latino. Get outside of Fort Lauderdale and Miami, Jacksonville, Tallahassee, Orlando, and in my opinion, there's not a whole lot of blacks in Orlando. And let's say Tampa, St. Pete area, Florida's hands down white. So that's the way it is. I mean, now, the largest concentration of blacks, and they're still in predominantly white states, you're going to find in the South. We're talking about North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, the one Louisiana. But in Louisiana, once you get outside of New Orleans, it's mostly white. And I'm throwing Baton Rouge, too. That's two cities. So Tennessee, Arkansas, but once you get outside of Little Rock, it's mostly white. So when it comes to, like, the CIA agency, we're just absent. I mean, you can't have 13% in every state when the people don't even exist. So that's why I got a problem with the term, what do you call it, token. But anyway, so he's a token in his department at the CIA. Hold on, where did I leave off at? Okay. He's a token black person. After mastering the agency's tactics, however, he becomes disillusioned and drops out to train black people in Chicago to become freedom freedom fighters. Okay, wait a minute. As the story of one man's reaction to the white man's ruling class hypocrisy, the film is loosely autobiographical and personal. Okay, so the film, directed by Ivan Dixon, who some of you, if you're familiar with Hogan's Hero, he was a black dude for the first five seasons. He didn't sign on for the sixth season. He quit. And they had another black dude, but for the first five seasons, Ivan Dixon, who played Sergeant Kinslow. Anyway, that's who we're talking about. But that's his most prominent role, Ivan Dixon. Written by Melvin Clay and Sam Greenlee, you know, the original author. Let's see. Based on the book by Sam Greenlee, The Spook by Sat by the Door, or produced by Ivan Dixon and Sam Greeley. Let's see, and starring Lawrence Cook, Paula Kelly, Janet Leigh, Jay Preston, and David Lemieux. And music by Herbie Hancock. Release date September 21st, 1973. 102 minutes long. And it says here, the novel and the film also dramatize the CIA's history and giving training to persons and or groups who later utilize their specialized intelligence training against the agency. Example of blowback. Well, let me read blowback. Okay. Blowback is a term originating with the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, explaining the unintended consequences and unwanted side effects of a covert operation. To the civilians suffering the blowback of covert operations, the effect typically manifests itself as random acts of political violence without a discernible direct cause because the public whose name the intelligence, or anyway, you can read about it. They got examples here. The Nicaragua Iran-Contra, which that is featured in the TV show Snowfall. And if you've listened to any videos by Rick Ross, Freeway Rick Ross, that one, he got his cocaine when he was dealing. Well, VIA, CIA hookup. This is all documented. So let's see. Any event, any of your thoughts, 619-768-2945. I'm thinking about one scene in particular. And for me, it's the type of film I might have to watch it two or three more times to really process it. But there was one scene where he was in the pool hall and he was asked to leave by the people in there. So he went out back, out the back way, and he was confronted by some black folks that didn't want him in there. So he left out the back door and he sat down and he waited for them to come out. As they came out, he took control of the situation. I think it was four of them. But I guess there's some stuff he learned at the CIA. In any event, it's considered a classic. I think it's registered at the Smithsonian. But any comments on it, 619-768-2945. Ivan Dixon himself, I did not see him in the film. But like I said, he directed it, and for him, that's in a few interviews I've found of Ivan Dixon. This is one of his. This film is one of his crown jewel films. Now the title, and I go to the phone lines in a minute. Title refers to a practice in the early days of affirmative action, when the first black person hired by a company or agency would be seated close to the office entrance so that all who came and went could see that the company was racially mixed. The word spook in the title has a dual meaning, a racial slur for an African-American or a slang term for spy. The dual meaning plays a role in the plot of the 2000 Philip Roth novel, The Human Stain, as well as the film made after the book. This is shown in Spook when Freeman is asked to give a tour of senators. I remember that scene. After Freeman takes the senator on a tour, one of the senators stays back and congratulates the general for integrating Freeman into his personal staff. The general tells his second in command that making Freeman a part of his personal staff, and this was before he actually became that officially, sounds like a good idea. The agent responds by saying, "We can put him out in reception so that all of our visitors can see that we're integrated." I remember that scene well. Anyway, film review, Spook That Sat by the Door, 410 area code, your mic is open.
Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you.
Well, I did have some abrasive comments, but, you know, I can't say what I want to say. But anyway.
It's a free, internet. Unregulated.
No, I'm out in public.
What you want to
so
say?
I'm in the park. I'm out in public. But anyway, look.
Oh, okay.
A couple of things that you said. Well, the most important thing is, I don't know if you paid attention to it or you've seen Sam Greenlee's interviews. Totally funded in the hood. All of the money that came to produce that movie was in the hood. Ivan Dixon went to Hollywood to try to get it funded, couldn't get any funding. Greenlee and Ivan Dixon was instrumental in totally funding that project.
Now, I think one of those videos you sent me, I did see that. I remember him saying that.
Yeah. Yeah, he said they couldn't get no money in Hollywood. He said, well, look, let's go to the hood and get the money. There's some money out there. So it was totally financed by everybody in the hood, and I'm using quoted words here.
Right.
And the other thing is you said that he learned that stuff in the CIA. Well, like if you notice in the judo scene, he was the only black belt that was there beside the two instructors. So he went there as a black belt.
Right.
So he had skills before he got there.
True.
And if you can read between the lines, he went there specifically to organize a subversive unit in the hood. That was his main mission because all the rest of those boys was just there for the opportunity and to be tokens.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they said if we go in and all of us keep our scoring down, they'll grade us by the curve and we'll make it. Well, the whole program was to make sure that none of them made it, but he made it. I don't know if you saw that conversation between the two CIA officials. They said, well, hey, wait a minute. You told me nobody was going to make it. So he wasn't supposed to make it.
Okay.
And the only reason they volunteered those brothers for the program was because, like politicians in today, the guy was running behind, the senator was running behind by one percentage point, and the only difference that would separate him from his opponent was the African-American vote. So they came up with the scheme, hey, we're going to use that to try and entice African Americans to vote for him, and that'll be the deciding factor that'll get me to win. So throughout the movie, they were being used, but the gentleman that you're discussing, the star of the show, I forgot his name, but the thing is, the brother that succeeded in really becoming a member, he took advantage of the opportunity. He said, look, you know, I know why I'm here. And the thing is, it's not because of my intelligence and it's not because of my skills. I'm here as a token. So the thing is, it had a lot of hidden messages in it.
Lawrence Cook is the actor's name who played that.
Right. Because he told him, he said, hey, look, we're not here because of our academic prowess or something like that. So he knew that they were being used. But he used them while they were trying to use him. And if you look at it, I mean, it's all about organizing. You talk about social capital all the time. And the way he went about going in and getting the people that he needed to carry out his mission, that's a perfect example of organization. If you look at it.
He did do
because
that.
Because he went straight to the gangbangers.
Yeah, I was about to say that. That's what he did.
Yeah. And the gangbangers, if you notice, they're the most organized people in the hood. Besides the church.
Unfortunately,
so,
you're right.
He went there specifically to do that because he said he was once a gangbanger himself. if you notice that scene when he first got off the airplane that was going in town, he was saying that he used to be a Cobra. So, I mean, the film has a lot of hidden messages that, you know, everybody focuses in on the violence. But the thing is, it was all about organizing the community to make a change.
Now, when I think of gangs, I'm primarily thinking of Chicago and Los Angeles. And it seems like some of the gangs in Chicago have political clout.
Well, again, Sam Greenlee, if you look at those interviews, the gangs, well, let's go back. Fred Hampton. If you look at the interviews about Fred Hampton, he organized the gangs, he organized the churches, he organized the street people, he organized the NAACP, all of them. And that's what got him killed. Because
he organized all of that.
Huh?
I didn't realize he had that much influence. All right, okay.
I'll send you the link. And
so
his
like
thing
21
was
21 years old when they killed him.
Yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
Very charismatic brother, very good organizer, but he organized all of that. And look, I'm gonna give you this. After they killed him, what he did was some of his influence lasted after him. That was how Harold Washington got elected. Because the gangbangers went out in the street and they turned out in masses to vote for Harold Washington.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know the story behind Harold Washington. He shocked the world when
you know,
he became
all I know is that he. All I know about him is he told somebody or a group of people he'd run, but they need to raise $1 million first. That's all I know.
Well, it was a mass organizing move, too, and I'll send you the link on that because everybody that was anybody in the hood voted, and the gangbangers turned out in masses to vote and to turn out to vote.
Hmm.
So he wouldn't have gotten elected any other way because, you know, Daily Machine ran that town. And Harold Washington shocked the world by becoming elected and becoming mayor of that city. I mean, it was a big coup. But that movie that you're talking about, I mean, it has a lot of hidden messages in there that really
I know I might have to go watch it at least 3 or 4 more times because there's a lot there.
Yeah, there's a lot there. And if you notice, the policeman was his best buddy, but he was in the system. And his girlfriend, the one that he was supposed to marry, that married another guy, they got together and turned him in.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a very interesting movie. And the thing is, the FBI came in there and stopped everybody from showing that movie. Theater owners.
Hey, they shut them down for a bit.
Yeah, in fact, the reason why it's an underground success is because you can't find that movie anywhere on the shelf. I think Amazon does carry it now, but most of the time it's distributed by bootleggers. Now, that's the only way I was able to sell it because I used to sell that movie.
Hmm. Of course, you had a vendor that you bought it from.
Yeah.
And I guess when you were selling it, basically internet wasn't, you know, everybody's got internet or access internet now. So I guess you sold it at those swap meets or flea markets.
Yeah, I used to do flea markets, and then I had that store there in Baltimore.
Oh, that's
also.
Right. You had the store, so you can sell it there, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, hold it. You sold it as a DVD or with the what is a VCR age?
Yeah, I sold it as a VCR at the time. I did all of my stuff in the 90s. So VHS tapes was popular then. That's the way I sold it.
All right. Yeah, it's a cult classic. And whatnot. But, I'm going to have to watch it. I know I'm going to watch it at least two or three more times, at least.
Well, I tell you what,
leave it alone for a while. You come back. Well, I didn't see that scene. I didn't notice that.
Which one?
I can tell it's that type of film now.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, the thing is, the FBI came in and threatened all of the movie owners and forced them not to show that movie. Because in the interview, when you look at the interviews that I sent you, Sam Greenlee, he said the first week that sucker was a blockbuster. And after that, they was wondering why they weren't getting the returns that they were getting. And come to find out, the FBI had threatened those movie owners. And even the distributor, the FBI told him, said, well, look, we'll make sure that you make some money, but you got to stop distributing that movie. And I don't know if you, again, when you look at the movie, Sam Greenlee said that one of the black guys that was going through an FBI course to become an FBI agent, that was required viewing for them as a training tool.
Yeah, I did. I remember that.
Yeah.
Well, as far as the bankrolling of that film, because Superfly, which came out, I guess, around, maybe not at the same time, but within a 2 or 3 year radius of that, that was bankrolled by, in a similar fashion. That was an independent film, too. But
yeah,
it's totally different. In Superfly, you're talking about drug dealers.
Right.
And they weren't a part of, established government agency or nothing like that.
Right, right.
But with this film, like I say, it's a 60, guys. It has a 60, a heavy 60s, early 70s feel to it. And, the affirmative action piece in there. And he was the first, because I remember the scene when he's in the, I guess, mail room, and that white woman comes
right
down there. And that's the scene that leads up to him showing the senators around.
Right, right.
But, that's I just never saw it, so I'm glad you recommended it.
Did you notice the scene about when she went down there to the copying room, the reprocessing room? She asked him, "Say, well, you don't know me. I mean, you don't like me, do you? Because when you come in there, you don't."
I remember her saying that.
Well, I know you got the message.
And also when he left out with the senators, and like the guy said, he one of the people stayed back. And he assumed that he was already a part of this guy's personal circle. But anyway, he later became that. But excellent. Now, I think a lot of stuff in that film is still relevant today.
Very relevant. Very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
Except for the one part. Nobody goes into these organizations to learn how they function and then come back to the hood and use that to uplift their people.
No, that hasn't happened as of yet.
And I don't think it will. But I want to say this while it's on my mind. The prostitute was a very interesting character too, wasn't she? Paula Kelly.
Paula Kelly?
Yeah.
Yeah, played by Paula Kelly. Yeah, she was. I remember the scene where she's being interviewed, you know, part of that exhaustive background check they do on people.
Yeah.
But she didn't say anything out of pocket.
And then she gave him some very intelligent, she did some very intelligence work too, because the head of the CIA was her client, remember?
Right.
And she contacted him and said, look, you know what, they're out to get this guy, which she didn't know he was a guy, either she figured he was a guy, and said, look, they're out to stop this insurrection, and when they find him, they're going to kill him. And that's when he told her, he said, well, look, you know, find out all you can. Don't pry, but when I get to D.C., we'll meet. Do you remember that scene?
Yeah, I do.
Mm. Yeah. But, you know, you got to have people that's in intelligence that can gather information to help you when you're doing stuff. So you'll know what your opposition is thinking, too.
That's true. That helps keep you alive. In a case like his and whatnot.
And look, let me give you this one while my mind is on. Remember when he said he was leaving to help, you know, to find another job? You notice they kept a watch on him. He said, create a dossier on him and find out what he's going to do and where he's at once he left the agency.
Yeah, I remember that. And the thing is, it seems like, man, yeah, watching that film is like, man, I wouldn't want a government job. Particularly, well, put it this way. One, for me, if I had to work for any government agency, let it stop and start at the local public library. Because those jobs where you need a government clearance, it's like, you're like, I mean, they can tap phones, you don't know it. You know, talk to people that you just, you know, it's an open book.
Well, depending on what government agency you work for. Now, if you're working for intelligence agencies and things like that, or either you working in ordnance, they're going to make sure they follow you until you die. You know, the guys that do demolition and doing bombs and stuff, or either guys
right.
that do spying. Gather intelligence, yeah. They're going to follow you until you die because they know that, hey, you know some of their secrets, and the thing is you might use that for, you know, what you're supposed to use it for. But what
yeah,
I was
like
into,
Tim,
I mean,
like
I wouldn't have to worry about that.
Timothy McVeigh, he was just in the Army or something like that.
Yeah.
Just a regular rank-and-file soldier, and you see what he did. So I guess with some of the people that are in intelligence, with some of, you know, I think Edward Ames, there's been a couple of those guys who have been caught spying. And I'm thinking, you know what, you already know that you don't know when they're checking up on you, who they talk to and whatnot. That's a lot of surveillance. Matter of fact, that must run them billions of dollars, or at least I know it costs them millions a year, if not billions, just checking up on the people that they already know that work for them in intelligence.
Well, L.A., I'm going to say something that a lot of your people, and I stress your people, will not believe. And you may not believe it either. But the United States government spends more money monitoring black folk than they do all these other nations in the world, North Korea, Russia, you name it. Most of their intelligence is done on black folk, all the way from the local level all the way up to the federal level. We are the most intensely spied on people and gathering information. You're talking about informants. You're talking about the former agencies like the FBI, CIA, Homeland Security, you name it. And then you have the police, and then you have the state agencies, the state SBIs and all of that stuff. They have departments specifically to monitor the actions of black folk. They even have hit squads. Well, all you got to do is look at Highway Ricky Ross.
Right. I remember my mother said once, when 9/11 happened, they're so busy watching us, they didn't watch everybody.
She said it right.
Else.
She said it right.
When 9/11 happened. Because nobody saw that coming.
No, and you know what? I think you said one time before, when they blew it up, that place down in Oklahoma City, the first name they mentioned was Farrakhan, wasn't it?
It's first name, Nation of Islam. I'll never forget it. Never forget it.
That's right. That's right. But they weren't looking for it to be Timothy.
Day, I don't know if it was 2 days, but that was the first one that went mainstream. I don't know if it was 2 days like that, but one full day of news. They were looking at the Nation of Islam, at least in the press.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
the thing is, the Nation has never done anything like that at all. Nowhere near it.
Well, that's not the point. The point is, hey, look, they're spreading a message that Negroes ain't supposed to hear. Do for self, self-defense, and going ahead on and making sure that you get land so that you can do whatever what you need to do and be independent of the system. See, that's kryptonite to a white society, whether you like to admit it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm just saying, you know, because, you know, hey, as long as you marching and you get spit on and get the dogs sicked on you and, you know, they pull stuff all over your head at a lunch count and you don't fight back and all of this stuff, you know, that's the way you're supposed to be. But when you talk about defending yourself and you're talking about being self-reliant and self-determining, that's a bad message.
Well, particularly after what's happened here. Matter of fact, in the last 2 to 3 years, I mean, George Floyd, the case, I guess it's South Carolina or Georgia. I think Georgia. With the father and son team, they got life sentences for killing a black man. And you know what? In none of those cases, the black man was fighting back.
You're not supposed to fight back. You're supposed to take that punishment, grin, and go on and don't complain. And that's why come I have a problem with these wannabe white folk that always is against reparations, because they know that will antagonize whites. They know that it's against the message
Now, you hit on something. If reparations was crafted for what happens today, that's a whole – see, that's personal injury today. But a lot of the reparations crowd, they're focused in on, you know, prior to, 1863. But that would be interesting if they craft reparations based on what happens today.
But see, you're missing the point. See, when you talk about reparations, you're talking about the brutalization of a group of people. And it's just like the Jews say, never again. And they
right.
And look, they constantly bring up the past. Nobody says anything about that. But they do that to make sure that, hey, look, you're always on alert to make sure that if somebody tries that again, they got to suffer the consequence. And the same thing about reparations. If enough black folk get to hear that message, how they were brutalized, how they were taken advantage of, how the women were raped, and just the overall viciousness of the system, see, you're going to piss a lot of people off and make them think differently about the system. That's why colored folks are scared to go in and talk about it, because they want you to forget it. But now, as long as the Jews or Indians or anybody else to talk about being brutalized and mistreated, hey, they're within their rights to do that. But they know if this reparation thing keeps being discussed, somebody going to see how vicious this system was and how badly black folks were treated. I don't want the damn money. I just want the this slavery institution exposed for what it was. That's worth more than money to me. But the thing is,
well, I think that'll eventually happen. I think that at first, well, I think it will happen because it's the push is there.
Well, not only the push, the more it's discussed, the madder black folks are getting. And that's what is needed for us to do what we need to do to become a self-reliant, independent-thinking people. See, as long as things is good, we don't mind being in the big house. As long as we get a few crumbs, like the Oprahs and the Bill Cosby before he was disgraced, and we can sit at the table and we can have cocktails with our oppressors, then we have no right to complain. But when the masses see how badly we were treated and how badly we were exploited, that's where the danger comes in at. And that's why come they want a whole lot of colored surrogates to talk against this reparation thing. But, you know, I'm just saying, you know, if it's good for the Jews, it should be good for black folk. If it's good for the Indians, it should be for the Indians. For black folks.
I believe, because they got some big push out there in California where, plus they got stuff, but I believe we'll get through. Let's see, we got another call here. 224, your mic is open.
Greetings, buenos dias. How's everyone?
Oh, you switched up on me.
No, it's just another phone line. Yeah,
that's what I mean. Yeah, I didn't have his number.
Yeah. It's actually not mine, but yeah.
So, what did you have for a favor? Did you happen to watch or ever watch the film The Spook Who Sat by the Door?
No, I did not.
Or were you ever a member of the Black Panthers in Chicago?
Yes. I remember my family talking about the Spook Who Sat by the Door, and then about the Black Panthers. My dad actually was a member at one point, but he was too powerful for me. You know, they weren't quite getting it. They probably wouldn't have been caught up after they came and took it to my dad. Fred Hampton?
Yeah, what do you know about Fred Hampton, Ariva?
Wow.
Well, you were young back then, though. Really young.
Yeah. So a lot that I had to actually research, watch documentaries, you name it. But Fred Hampton, I recall that he was a part of implementing free lunches in schools. He was, first of all, a leader or co-founder of the movement. I actually met his wife, his surviving wife, and his son at an event at the Alhambra House. Yeah. His son, actually, greeted him over the phone at first, but his son, pretty much, he don't know you. He looking like, I mean, I'm a little petite female. I would pose a threat, but I don't know. He just was like, I was trying to let him know who I was and that we actually spoke. Yeah. But it had been a few years. It didn't appear that he was guarding anybody or anything. His mom was, when I was able to greet her and give her good respect, he wasn't in the area, but I was just trying to say, just the sister that you talk to, I say that. They were doing this long before this fundraising. Nevertheless, I do recall that they were trying to save the house, the Hampton house. I don't know what happened with that. I'm just still learning more about the movement. I know that he was a baby that survived that tragic home invasion. He was the baby that the brother was holding, like, in a documentary. So I did see a documentary about it, about the whole police setup. And, yeah, so I did learn that way about what had occurred. They came in on the family while they were sleeping. Bobby Rush, one of the politicians here in Chicago, was a member of it. So I was able to see that, too. That was interesting. Because I remember my dad told me, but, you know, kind of different as a political leader. But, you know, but that's probably why he pulled away from the Black Panthers. That would be a good documentary to share with our young people, too. They have the new Black Panther movement. I saw a page on Facebook, and I don't know if that's what Fred Hampton Jr. is heading up, but the new Black Panther movement. I don't really see it as even a powerful movement. You know those guys that marched on the headquarters of the KKK with a military, these strapped-up military folks? This is after Ahmaud Arbery's murder. So we refer to it as a death, which is a death by murder. So they marched, all Black folk, men and women. Many of them were ex-military to the Capitol. And I would think that a lot of these groups, they would actually collaborate. You know, it's a movement. I don't know what that group called themselves. I don't know if you guys are aware of that. I actually caught news of that. Did y'all know that the Black folk marched on the grounds where the KKK headquarters. Are you guys aware of that? They marched on the headquarters of the KKK because they were talking about, killing all Black folk, and they said, "Come with it." I'm gonna share it with you guys.
Reba, have you seen the TV show Chi-Rock yet?
No, not that. I saw one episode, but it was...
Right, Chi-Rock's a movie. Yeah, it's a TV show, too, I think.
Okay. No, I thought I saw one episode. I don't have regular TV. I'm a YouTuber. Okay. You know, I normally watch, you know, when I'm busy with friends or whatever with my guy. Chi-Rock. It's a series, huh? No. I forgot about it. Yeah, grandfather, no.
I didn't see the movie, but the TV series, I saw a couple episodes on Amazon.
When they produce these those series like that, generally it doesn't seem to be realistic enough for what these young people actually deal with. It gives a narrative and it may be moving to a certain degree, but to really get real, I think that they should employ some young people who actually been there. Now they'd be the best actors. They keep them off the streets too, but you know these production companies that are not Black owned. And actually, I could see some Black owned may not even want to. I mean, I just think a lot of our leaders are too afraid of our children. Like, you know, at one point, I'm like, look, we out here dodging bullets anyway on daily. Why would I be afraid to talk to a young person? You know, just say, hey, you know, you're in school, you look for work, da da da. And sometimes the young men, they'll say, you know, I make my own money. I said, okay, so you hustle. I said, the job itself is a hustle. The job, you know, just over broke. I said, you know, you may be doing better financially, you know, but it's just, you know, many of us concern ourselves with the risk of being locked up. So I said, I do tell them. I did encourage this one young man but he's married now. I encouraged him to start a business. He said, yeah, you know, I've always wanted to start, because he was born into the game. It's like I met Larry Hoover, so one of the juniors, because it's a couple of juniors, which is weird. They were so anxious to make sure that people knew that she was having a baby by Hoover, so she named her baby Larry Hoover Jr. So there's like two juniors, which is two or three. Yeah. So I met two of them. Anyway, the one who I met, you know, we were talking, he was actually interested in dating. He's like, you wouldn't date me after we talked to him. He said, you wouldn't date me. He said, I know you're not gonna give me a chance. He said, I was born into the game. He said, I didn't choose this life. Now, the guy that I encouraged to come out of the game by investing, he did do that. He still, like, kind of went back and forth, but he said he'd always wanted to be a trucker. I actually met him at his father's repast. I thought to the funeral, and I knew his cousin. But, yeah, he said, I was born into the game, and that's interesting. But he was addicted to making that money. So I encouraged him to start, you know, go back to trucking or go to trucking school. And he had started before we stopped dating. He ended up finishing. I knew he had one truck at one point, but he did invest in some properties too, because that was something we always talked about. Actually, he had done it in property investment. And, you know, it's like we could talk all day about, like, preventing violence, just as any other. However, if we're teaching options for coming out, for coming off of the street, you know, with that respect, I would never tell a young person, don't protect yourself. A lot of young people have survived gang shootings, you name it. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that they're trained military style or prepared to be sharp shooters. And because that's my issue. It's like, you know, when I was growing up, Fred Hampton days and all that, yes, and yes, I was a little girl, and they were still doing that thing. They were organized, and they had a hat. If they found that somebody was out shooting crazy, wilding out like that, there was some accountability. We don't shoot women and children. We go after our man. And, you know, I just, because they
well,
have
now, what about what about one figure we were talking about, I guess earlier this week or last week or something, Yummy. Yummy was 11 years old in a gang, and he was killed by two members of the gang he was in.
I think it was jealousy, too. That was weird. 11 years old, and then how did he?
You know, 11 years old, you know.
Yeah.
That's Cub Scout age.
From what I heard, he was pretty rough. He wasn't no punk. He was a young, not just young rebel, but he was tough. From what I heard, even from people who knew him.
Well, you know, here's because Yummy was a real life character. Sandifer, I forgot his first name, but he reminds me of the character of that which was fictional on the TV show The Wire. Kennard. Kennard ended up killing one of the main characters of Omar of the and just getting people who's not. Omar was about that character was about maybe 10 years old, a 10-year old drug dealer with a profane mouth, and he ended up. I mean, he would do stuff like set cats on fire, and then he, like I said, he was his. But you know, and he ended up killing an adult gangbanger. But he ended up killing Omar. Now, this is the TV show The Wire, which is fictional.
Well,
loosely based on some real life characters, though. But Kennard ended up killing somebody old enough to be his dad. And then at the end of The Wire, you see him get arrested. Now, Yummy, he was real.
He was a full-fledged
gang member at 11.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And so from what I'm saying, he was active and doing because of robbing and shooting.
Oh, what I was getting ready to say about Kennard in The Wire, you never saw Kennard with a family member. You didn't see him at his mother's house, no grandparents, no big brother, nothing. So with Yummy, Yummy's real name, let me get to Wikipedia. His real name was Robert Sandifer, S-A-N-D-I-F-E-R, Robert Sandifer. He was born March 12, 1983, and he transitioned by assassination September 1st, 1994. His street name was Yummy. Was an 11-year-old from Chicago, Illinois. His murder by fellow gang members in Chicago garnered national attention because of his age, resulting in the appearance of him on the cover of Time magazine in September 1994. His nickname originates for his love of cookies. Standing at 4'6" tall, Sandifer was a young member of the Chicago street gang, the Black Disciples. After committing murder, he went out at 11. Now, according to this on Wikipedia, after committing murder, arson, and robbery, and armed robbery, he was murdered by his own fellow gang members who feared he could become an informant. Now, there's some YouTube videos where I think the woman interviewed, I don't know if it was his mother, but his aunt, or where were these, where, I mean, come on, 11, where was his familial support? That's what I want to know. But you're right, he was off the chain before he got shot and killed.
I mean, I am going to watch the movie just to see, because of course I can watch it on YouTube, you say, right?
The Spook Who Sat by the Door, that's free on YouTube. Because, and the movie, the backdrop of the movie is in Chicago.
I believe they
shot a lot of this on location in Chicago.
Okay.
Matter of fact, had I saw the movie before I caught that flight to Chicago, I probably wouldn't have. I've been through Chicago before, you know, on flights. But when you met me, that was the first time I ever spent any type of time on the ground in Chicago. Once I traveled from Detroit to Milwaukee, but we were driving, so we drove through Chicago. We didn't stop off in Chicago. So when you met me, when I met you in Pleasant, that's actually the first time I actually spent some time in neighborhoods, you know, saw a little bit of between Midway to Pleasant House. And then when you drove me back to the airport, you know, that's all I know about Chicago so far on the ground. But had I watched this movie, I might not have showed up. But they did the same thing to D.C. Because typically, a lot of times when the area gets bad mouth, you know, then people move out, and the next thing you know, the demographics of the city totally change.
Okay, this boy was physically abused from the time he was an infant.
Okay.
Okay, it says Sandifer's mother, Lorena Sandifer, had over 30 arrests while prostituting, many of which were drug-related. Sandifer's father, Robert Aiken, was absent throughout Sandifer's life due to incarceration for a felony gun charge. Sandifer was physically abused from the time he was an infant. Before year 3, Sandifer was already known to the DCFS. Physical examination showed that Sandifer was alleged to have had cigarette burns on his arms and neck, as well as linear bruising. Lorena initially blamed the abuse on Sandifer's father, although she later recanted.
So, yeah, there's more on Wikipedia.
Yeah, I'm reading Robert Young Sanford joined the Black Disciples in 1994. Now, the Black Disciples, that gang is still active in Chicago. Anyway, at the age of 11 years old, he was given a 9mm semi-automatic pistol by his gang chief and was sent out to kill some rival gang members. While aiming for his rivals, a spray bullet from Yummy's gun hit and killed a 14-year-old female pedestrian, Siobhan Dean. This brought a much unwanted attention to the Black Disciples from local and national news. The gang leader sent out two brothers, Derek Hardaway and Craig Hardaway, and I believe they have videos of these two online. To get rid of Yummy. The two brothers lured Yummy into an underpass and shot him twice in the back of his head. They were later convicted of murder, and more undesired attention was brought upon the Black Disciples, despite their efforts to cover up the gang's involvement. So despite all that, the Black Disciples, according to Wikipedia, is still active, and they have anywhere between 9,000 to 12,000 members.
Oh, so he was ordered to do a favor for his gang to murder.
Well, that's part of the initiation, I guess. But I'm thinking now, why would it?
Well, but
I have no idea of gang culture.
Right?
Huh?
Yeah. He joined the gang in 93.
Obviously,
so
there's
no
age barrier to get in.
Right. Looks like it took some time for them to get him to do that. I thought you had to commit like a murder or something like that just to get in. But he joined the gang in 93. And then in August of 94, he was ordered to do the gang murder. Mm.
Now, according to Wikipedia, the criminal activities, and I guess their business, arms trafficking, burglary, extortion, drug trafficking, illegal gambling, kidnapping, money laundering, murder, racketeering, robbery, theft, those are some of their profit centers in the Black Disciples. But that's a significant amount of people, 9,000 to 12,000 members. So I'm thinking about what Beasley said about, because, you know, the churches, you know, have more people than that, but 9,000 people, that's a significant amount of people.
Yeah. They said when they're talking about it,
I don't know.
That's a lot. You can't even, he said, the psychologist said that he was growing up without any emotional and without any encouragement and support.
Well, when are we going to have another couples building wealth?
Well, I will be prepared because even I don't necessarily need the phone line service. I'm going to just go Wi-Fi this evening. We could do the 6 o'clock couples building wealth. What do you suggest our topic be?
No, let me tell you this. You can pick this up. We're on the 4 acres I have down here. We'll be doing the first building will be called Gratitude House.
Okay.
And on the first acre, because it's 4 acres, that will be called Gratitude Village.
Okay.
Gratitude is something that fits in with everybody. Regardless of race, religion, even if they're atheists, you know, atheists can be grateful too. So, well, what do couples fight over? Couples fight over money or something like that?
Stop the fighting and start building. Yeah, money, insecurity.
What works
you know,
on Clubhouse
feeling
a lot
that
of time?
Don't get enough attention.
What works on Clubhouse a lot of time is but you know, I wanted to plug you into Patrick Collins.
I'm familiar with that. Must know that name through you.
Well,
yeah, that's Marva Collins' son. Yeah.
Yeah, Marva Collins' son. All right, I'm gonna end this podcast now. But if you call me on my 425 number, I can do a three way. Like within about 3 or 4 minutes.
All right. Was that Brother Delmar or Brother Tianchi? Who is the other guest in that show? Who is the other speaker guest in that show?
No, it's not. It's all it's going to be is a phone call.
No, who was that that was just speaking with you?
Oh, that was Beasley. Connie Beasley.
Beasley, okay. Okay. That's fine. All right. So I will talk to you shortly then.
Okay. You got my 425 number?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Call on me. All right. Fine.
All right.